So last week, for those of you who weren't here, we had a look at the first four of the nine songs of the Song of Songs. The first song, I'm just speaking very generally, was about love. The second song was the springtime of love. The third was one about unfulfilled yearning, different moods of love, clearly. And the fourth was the wedding day. I pointed out to you that the songs are about sexual love, male-female love. That's what they're about. But I also let you know about the Jewish and then the Christian use of this as a metaphor for God's love for the community, and then God's love for the individual person, hence all that mystical writing of the fathers of the church and so on.
Did we miss all that last week?
You did.
Absolutely. Oh, dear.
One thing happened last week. I made a comment, I'm going to take it a little bit further, on that statement, draw me after you, let us make haste. The king has brought me into his chambers. And I read to you from St. Bernard, and then I couldn't think of a sonnet by John Donne, wouldn't come to my aging mind, but I brought it for you today. So I'll just go back over that again. The comment made by St. Bernard on that, draw me, and let us make haste, reads again, I'm tired, says St. Bernard, I'm faint. Do not abandon me. Draw me in your footsteps to prevent me from following other lovers haphazardly. Draw me in your footsteps, for it's better for me to be drawn, even violently so, even threateningly so, even in punishment, rather than for you to be soft on me and leave me insecure, a prey to my own torpor. Draw me thus against my will. Get my consent forcefully. Tear me away from my inertia. Throw me into the race. The time will come when I do not need to be pulled, since we will run together with all our heart effortlessly. And the sonnet I was trying to think of, I now have to show you, is John Donne, Batter My Heart. I'll just read it for you. It's got the same feeling. It's so important to love that they're calling on God to force us to do it. Like, even if it hurts, don't leave us sitting down watching Days of Our Lives for the rest of our life. Let's whatever. So this is John Donne, who didn't have the advantage of television. Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, excuse the spelling, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me, bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town to another due, labour to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me should defend, but is captured and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you and would be loved fain, but I am betrothed to your enemy. Divorce me, untie, break that knot again. Take me to you. Imprison me. For I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, unless you ravish me. Very similar, as you can see, to Bernard's thing. How we all learn, that's tradition, it's so rich, how we need the tradition to keep drawing on us for our own spiritual growth and enlightenment. Okay, so we move now to the fifth psalm. He now, the blue is him, the red is her, and the green is what I think the corpus part of it. So he says, how beautiful you are, my love, how very beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them is bereaved. Difficult for me not to smile when I read that, but I have to remember, you have to remember, that in these days, having a full set of teeth was very rare. So she's got a beautiful smile and all her teeth are there, and that's really quite an astonishing achievement, even for a 20-year-old woman, because teeth tended to come out and get lost and break and wasn't much to do about it. So it's the wedding night when he's speaking to her. He's admiring her beauty, obviously. His opening words echo earlier verse about the love, the eyes of the dove you've seen earlier. The image of a veil evokes the sense of concealment and the excitement of discovery. I'm not going to make any social comment on modern sexual habits or anything, but somebody should tell the women and the men who organise the women to do it that there's nothing more attractive than a veiled woman. I mean, you know, like, there is a bit of a tendency today, isn't there, even in ordinary dress, to show nearly everything. Whereas, well, anyway, I won't tell you what you know better than I. There's something attractive about the wonder and the mystery of the beautifully clothed person. So this veil evokes a sense of concealment and the excitement of discovery. He must uncover her to see her beauty. Her dark hair cascading down her neck and breasts excites him like the black goats frolicking on the slopes of Gilead. An unusual image, but the imagery moves from that of black goats to white sheep, washed clean as they come up out of the water, shining white and in pairs, just like the intact set of teeth revealed by her alluring smile. Your lips are like a crimson thread, and that's without makeup. That's my bit. That's not in the Song of Songs. Your lips are like a crimson thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Thanks to our beautiful Barbara, I can show you a pomegranate as it comes off the tree, I presume. That's how much I know about it. That's it. And here is the pomegranate half. And when you take away, I'm told that little veil of white there is very bitter, but behind it, bursting out, is all these seeds of, and they're very sweet. And so that's the pomegranate, which is used right through the biblical literature, psalms and so on, as a symbol of love. Yeah. So her crimson lips and the beauty of her mouth invite the kisses already featured in the opening verse, the opening poem. As his tongue probes the inside of her cheeks, he thinks of the sweet taste of the pomegranate, a symbol also of fertility because of the profusion of the seed. The second allusion to the veil, which we've just seen there, adds to the mystery and his arousal to search deeper into her as yet inaccessible beauty. He continues. Again, the imagery is not what we'd use, but let's try and enjoy it in its own. Your neck is like the Tower of David. Now, blokes, I wouldn't suggest you do that, and I'm not here to suggest how you do what you do, but I don't think she'd be too flattered if you said to your wife, your neck is like the Tower of David. Built-in courses. On it hang 1,000 bucklers, all of them shields of warriors. Take it as a compliment, it's meant to be. So let's see why it's a compliment. David, Hebrew Dawid, echoes the enduring term that she regularly uses when she addresses him as my love, Dodi, Dawid Dodi. Warriors used to hang their hand shields, bucklers, and the larger body shields on the battlements of the tower, giving the tower an appearance of ornate splendour and strength and kind of reflected light and all of that. The image is evoked by her layered necklace, which she's already referred to back in chapter 1, verse 9. Your two breasts, he says to her, are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, that feed among the lilies, until the day breathes and the shadows flee. I will hasten to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. I've put the Hebrew word for frankincense in there for a reason that I'll point out in a moment. Labona. Labona is the Hebrew word used there, and that's word for this most precious of the scented things that are brought in by the caravans. So he will hasten to the mountains of myrrh. He's intoxicated by her allurement and is hastening to complete the union he desires. You are altogether beautiful, my love, he says. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon. This is the Labona. And Lebanon, you can see I put there the Hebrew word. If you put it both together, it's the same consonants and very similar sound. Come with me from Lebona, Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions and the mountains of leopards. Amana and Senir, Senir is mentioned in Deuteronomy, and Hermon, they're peaks of the anti-Lebanon range, that is the eastern range, and then there's the Lebanon range, and then there's the famous Bekaa Valley in between them. So it's unapproachable, these peaks, because of the dense forest, the lair of wild animals. Is there also, perhaps, an allusion to the Assyrian goddess Ishtar, from which most probably Esther comes, the Hebrew name Esther. Ishtar was the Assyrian goddess who's frequently pictured with lions and leopards. As earlier she was hidden from him in the clefts of the rock, so here she must leave her secret lair and come to him. She's unattainable. He wants her and she's, whatever, you get the feel of it. And for the first time, he actually calls her my bride. They are now wedded and he longs to consummate the union with her. He continues, you've ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. You've ravished my heart with the glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. So it's a long song of the bridegroom to the bride. In an ecstasy of lovemaking, Dodim, all his senses are aroused. His sight, his taste, his smell, touch. Just as in a previous poem she was faint from the sensations of love, so here he's the prisoner, ravished by her love. She spoke of his love earlier as better than wine. Her love is the same for him. Earlier she spoke of his presence in terms of the fragrance of spiced oils. Here too the experience is the same for him. He speaks of the nectar of her kisses. last week in doing the first four songs, I did a whole lot with you, I hope, well, reading from the Fathers of the Church and right up to St. Bernard and so on, giving you the metaphorical use of this intimacy, this sexual intimacy as a sacrament, symbol of the love we all desire from God, the most profound love. And so they often go into poetic ecstasies over this, and I read a lot of it to you. There's not as much of that tonight because so you got the bulk of that last week. I'll do a couple of bits with you, but this is pretty well focused, where that poem is focused, on the male-female communion, desire, consummation, sexual love. And he continues, "Your lips distill nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The scent of your garments is like the scent of Lebanon." Lebanon. The scent of Lebanon carries extra meaning in the Hebrew through the likeness in sound of the word, I've got it, Lebanon, Lebanon, and the most precious of spices, the frankincense, Lebona. You could see it and hear it. And then he goes on, "A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a garden locked, a fountain unsealed." The image is, of course, of the female hymen. So it's locked, the garden. He needs permission and whatever desire to come into her precious garden. And here we've got Ecclesiastes and the Book of Proverbs using similar images for this. "I made myself gardens and parks. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the orchard of growing trees." That's Ecclesiastes 2:5. Proverbs, "Let your fountain be blessed," Proverbs 5:18, "and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. May her breasts satisfy you at all times. May you be intoxicated always by her love." Surely you do see the kind of, they're all using, this is the imagery of the wisdom, prophetic literature in relation to sexual love. Taking that sentence again and continuing a bit further. "A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. Your channel," and I'll leave that for you to work out what that must mean, "is an orchard of pomegranates with its choicest fruits." The word orchard I put in Hebrew there for those of you who can read Hebrew. Pardes. And that's one of the words I gave you earlier, which is a Persian word from which we get paradise. Pardes. So it's a borrowed word for an orchard, a garden of fruit trees, which you can see plenty of in that part of the world. I'll go back again. "A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. Your channel is an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits. Henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all chief spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water, flowing streams from Lebanon." Are you all managing this all right? You're not getting carried away or anything. But you're meant to enjoy it anyhow, because then you know what it's meant to, what it's saying. And as I said last week, in one sense, though both the Jewish community and then the church accepted the Song of Songs, most of them seem to have accepted it because of the metaphorical connection. And maybe Christianity more than Judaism, I think, but maybe we went too quickly into the metaphor. It's actually about the wonder of sexual communion. And then, of course, the rest follows. But if you jump too quickly to the metaphor and miss the essential symbol and sacrament, as always. If we go to God before we go to where God is manifest, we get the wrong God. So in a sustained metaphor, the man compares her to an enclosed garden with a fountain at the centre. Only she can unlock the gate to the garden and permit entry and invite him to break the seal into the channel that leads to the paradise, to the orchard, where flows the hidden, life-giving spring. The pomegranate is an aphrodisiac, or is considered one, a symbol of fertility, and the other exotic herbs are noted for their aroma. And he concludes, "How beautiful you are, my love, how very beautiful." Read to you from the rest of scripture a little bit here. The king, this is Psalm 45, which was sung on the wedding day of the king, possibly Ahab, I'm not sure, and Jezebel. That was possibly the wedding for which it was written, but that's only a possibility. The king will fall in love with your beauty. She holds that beauty solely for him, as is recalled in Ezekiel, who writes, chapter 16, "The fame of your beauty spread through the nations since it was perfect, because I had clothed you with my own splendor." That's God now speaking to the people, the community. This is why the bride would be quite wrong in worrying whether she's truly lovable or not, and worthy or not of love. And we can do that. We can wonder whether we're worthy of love. I suppose we do that. And I'm suggesting here that in this biblical sense, that's not a good track to be going down, because we're all worthy of love. All her beauty is made by her resemblance to her bridegroom. The beauty you have as an individual and I is given us by God. So we are worthy of love, even though we've got memories of things that jag in there and we think, but we can't lose that the mystery of God, you being and me being made in the likeness of God, means that everyone is actually worthy of love. And we shouldn't deny that. And sin can't actually stop that. "Whose holy face was engraved in her since the very first day and wants to be more and more deeply engraved in her." Teresa Lisieux was commenting on that verse, praying that verse of the Song of Songs. And she writes, and remember, it was Teresa of Lisieux of the Infant Jesus, remember that? Mm-hmm. But the rest of her title, which is often forgotten, "And Holy Face." That's her. She was Teresa of the Infant Jesus and the Holy Face. Pity that second bit doesn't get as much, because it's critical. Well, here she is saying in her spiritual biography, "Adorable face of Jesus, only beauty ravishing my heart. Deign to imprint on me your divine resemblance, so that you may not be able to look into my soul without seeing yourself." I don't know what to make of that, but anyhow, that's what she said. So, now, the bridegroom has been saying a lot. It's a bit of a change, because all the early songs were mostly the bride. And now she actually, this is the concluding part of the song. She says, "Awake, O north wind." And I've got the Hebrew there for Zaphon. Zaphon was the myth. Like the Greeks had Olympus, you know, up in the north part. That was their mystical mountain on which the gods gathered. Well, in the Semitic world, the mystical mountain of the north was Zaphon, and that's where their gods gathered, etc. So the north wind takes on the wind from the gods. "Awake, O north wind," the Zaphon. "Come, O south wind," Teman, another name for Edom, the mountains down south, in the mountains there. blow upon my garden, that its fragrance may be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. So she's now saying, fine, come. She's inviting him in. She's calling on the winds to fan the perfume, the perfumes of her garden, so that he will enjoy to the full his entry and eat its choicest fruits. She wants him to come into his garden. She offers herself to him for his pleasure. And he, delighted that she has said that, says, I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh with my spice. I eat my honeycomb with my honey. I drink my wine with my milk. So he welcomes her invitation, and look at all the verbs. I come, I gather, I eat, I drink. And the chorus then say to the two of them, eat, friends, drink, be drunk with love. They're applaud, they're not making. So that's the sixth, that's the fifth song. Just a beautiful man to woman and then welcoming of her to him. In the sixth song, it's her talking about him. There's a technical name for all these. I think you pronounce it wasf or something. It's an Arabic term for this kind of poetry, man to woman, woman to man. Well, this is mainly her now, but not only her. So she starts. And it's not continuous, the song, it's another angle on it. I sleep, she says, but my heart is awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking. She expresses her longing and anticipation. I sleep, this has been going on now from chapter 2, I sleep, I arose, I opened, I sought, I called, I'm faint with love, and now she hears her lover knocking to enter. And he says, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I won't make too much of this explicit because it's not up to me to do that, but you do need to keep watching for the double entendre right throughout here. So head wet with dew is not the head here, and the drops of the night, etc., and the locks, like you just need to imagine and recall and look at the situation that where there's another meaning to this poetry, and it's not unobvious. So he seeks entry to her and he can't wait any longer. This too is full of double meanings as she fantasizes about opening her door, inverted commas, to him. And this is what she says. I've put off my garment, how can I put it on again? I've bathed my feet. Feet throughout the Bible is frequently, normally, in all kinds of situations, an euphemism, I think that's the word for it, the genitals. So if I've bathed my feet, how can I soil them? My beloved thrusts his hand into the opening. My inmost being yearns for him. I arise to open to my beloved. My hands drip with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh. On the handles of the bolt. A few double meanings in there that I think should be reasonably clear. You don't need father to explain it. So she says, I opened to my beloved. So they have an encounter, the consummation of their love. Now, of course, can't go on forever. My beloved withdraws and is gone. My soul faints within me, she says. I seek him, but I don't find him. I call him, But he gives no answer. She doesn't want the union to end and immediately searches for him to do it again, to come again, but to no avail. Now, Pope Gregory the Great, so I'm not the only priest to have commented on the Song of Songs, Pope Gregory the Great has this comment: the bridegroom hides when he is sought, so that not finding him, the bride may seek him with a renewed ardour, and the bride is hampered in her search, so that this delay may increase the capacity for God, that she may find one day more fully what she was seeking. He's obviously taking it now into the metaphorical person's longing for the ultimate love, which is God. So we seek God and God's not answering your prayers, my prayers. God's not present. God's not felt to be present. All of this, says Gregory, is so that our desire will expand and our heart will open. The broken heart, of course, open, pierce, and we'll be capable of much more communion through that. And in a similar vein, two other saints. My soul, says the Song of Songs, faints within me. I seek him, but I don't find him. I call him, but he gives no answer. And St. Augustine, in his beautiful commentary on John's epistle, says, God, by making us wait, stretches desire. Stretching desire, he stretches the soul. Stretching the soul, he makes it capable of receiving. Such is our life. We must endeavour to desire. And Gregory of Nyssa, I think I quoted for you last week another quote from him, but this is from his homily on the Canticles, writes, God wants the delay in pleasure to set afire the desire of the soul, so that together with its ardour, joy may also increase. Finding God means seeking God continually. This is truly seeking God when one is not sated in desiring him. God is eternally sought. Which is one of the tragedies of atheism, like a mental atheism, would seem to me, I don't understand, but probably the atheist would be closing down an area of search by intellectually denying the existence of the sacred and the mystery. That seems to me a tragic thing to be doing, whereas belief in God doesn't mean we have God and we can't define God, of course, but it means that we're continually open to the mystery and the sacred and the wonder of it all, and we're not putting any intellectual block to that search. St. Bernard, quoted last week a lot in his commentary on the Canticle, writes, as soon as the word appears, after many vigils and endless prayers, long works and torrents of tears, he escapes all of a sudden, just when you thought that you could securely possess him. At another time, he'll come close to the one who weeps and runs after him. He lets himself be possessed for a while, but not kept forever, for just a moment later, he flees and escapes. Which we all know that experience, and there'd be other words to put on it, but it just means that we're always realising that when we use the word God, we're talking about something that is always beyond what we know and experience and see and all of that. So it's never locked in. And St. Justin, now we're going right back to the 2nd century AD. This is all very modern. Augustine and then Gregory of Nazianzen. Justin writes, Justin Martyr, He's a wonderful fellow. He's worth reading. Justin was a philosopher and a profound one, and he went through all the philosophies he could find. He went through Aristotelianism, Pythagoras, Plato. He was searching. And in a sense, he's a bit unusual because he found, as a philosopher, the most satisfying philosophical thing that gave meaning to his life was Christianity. So Christianity was drawing all kinds of people because of love and community and all of that. But here you have, and it's been the case right through the history of the world, of course, the last 2,000 years, here you have a leading philosopher travelling, searching, and he found Christianity to be the most satisfying, meaningful construct to give meaning to his life, which of course it is. But it's got to be presented, you know, it's got to be presented like that, not bluntly and without searching. Well, this is what he writes. Anyhow, he said, look, the very name God is not his name. If anyone dares to claim that God has a name, he's mad. These words, and these are the words we use, and they're good words, Father, God, Creator, Lord, Master, they're not names. They're words to call him because of his goodness and because of what he does, what we see him doing in the world. The word God is not a name, it's an approximation, which we find natural when we attempt to explain the unexplainable. It's good, isn't it? And if every time all of us used the word God, we were fully aware of that, there possibly wouldn't be atheists. Because atheism must be spawned by a narrow, too small God that's really quite either repulsive or too small for a thinking person to accept. Well, here's Gregory of Nazianzum. So that's the 4th century, 5th century, 4th century, I think. O you, he says, who are beyond everything, are not these words all that can be sung about you? What hymn could tell about you? What language? No word can express you. Only you are unutterable. Only you are unknowable. You are all beings and you are none of them. Yours are all the names, but how will I name you? The only one who cannot be named. O you who are beyond everything, is this not all that can be sung about you? Wonder of that. Okay, well, with that little, not exactly a digression, but I hope commentary on that, we return to the woman's words. Making their rounds in the city, the sentinels found me. They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle. These sentinels in the wall. So she met the sentinels earlier when she was searching, we did it last week, and they pointed her in what to do. Here the sentinels are really, there's some psychological thing going on in the woman. I suggest that she's struggling with the fact that she's lost her virginity. Even though he wanted to come and she wanted him to come, something really big has happened to her psychologically, and there's not a fight going on, but a complex emotional reaction to the love that she loved, but to the what's happened to her in opening herself to love. The sentinels are those things that guarded her virginity, and rightly so. Now she's gone beyond them, but they're still coming back to haunt her, or I don't know what words to use. You have to be a woman to kind of understand, but I think not anyhow. She says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I'm faint with love. Once again, she addresses the chorus. She begs them to intervene on her behalf and tell him of her yearning for him. And the chorus then, say in response to her request, what is your beloved more than the other? Any other beloved, O fairest of women, What is your beloved more than another one, that you would have us swear such an oath? And now she answers, this is what's special about him, and she then goes into a long poem of love, just as he had done in the earlier song. And here it is. Well, she says, my beloved is all radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. That's why he's so special. His inner and outer beauty radiates from him and lights up everything around him. He's ruddy, it was the word used of David as a young man. His complexion is full of life and energy and vitality. He's strong and healthy and youthful, and no one, she's saying, can compare to him. And now she gives. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk, fitly set. So the image behind that are the heads of the gods in their public, the agora, you know, the god. The gold heads symbolize divinity. So she's saying he's divine, really. Like the heads of the statues of gods, his head is the finest gold. It's not a visual image, it's a value statement. He's divine, his thick, wavy, dark hair, his eyes brimming over with love, and his constancy evoke the image of doves, which they've come throughout this song. His cheeks, she says, are like beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies, distilling liquid myrrh. His arms, she says, are rounded gold, set with jewels. His loins are ivory, hung with sapphires. You'll have to see the double meaning there. If you're talking about his loins and sapphires hanging from the loins, do I need to explain anything more? His legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. So she uses imagery taken from statuary to describe his body. Having spoken of his arms, she alludes to his belly with its sapphires, and like his head, his feet are of gold. She continues, his mouth is most sweet, he's altogether desirable. This is my beloved, this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now, mouth may mean his words, which she's just been listening to, and they're very attractive and very beautiful. It may also mean, of course, his kisses. In response, the chorus say, where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Which way has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? So they're questioning her. If he's all that fantastic, if she's so sure of his love, why has he gone away? Why is he withdrawn? Why isn't he here with her? Why does she need to go looking? And does she need their help? And her response, she knows where he is. Or her desire is quickly answered by him, so that the moment of anxiety is allayed. My beloved, she says, has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flock in the gardens, to gather lilies. So it's okay, girls, call off the hunt. He's here. Her beloved is not lost. She knows where he is. He's in his garden. That's her, of course. She knows that the spices can intoxicate him. She wants him to assuage his hunger in her arms and enjoy the fruit of their embrace. And she concludes, I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. He pastures among the lilies. She knows that he belongs to her. She belongs to him, and they will enjoy their mutual lovemaking. And now just the seventh song, which is only two pages, and then we'll take a break. He sings again of her beauty. So they're enjoying this. That's what they're meant to be doing. He's on again. You're beautiful like Tirza, my love. It's a bit like saying you're beautiful like Canberra, my love. I don't know how they take it, but that's because Tirza was the capital of the Northern Kingdom in the early stages, in the romantic early years. Okay. So you're beautiful like Tirza, my love. You're comely like Jerusalem. Terrible as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. He's starting to repeat himself. So he's run out of poetic inspiration. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. We've heard that before. All of them bear twins, and one of them is bereaved. She's probably saying, darling, you said that last night. I don't know. So, but anyhow, it's a repetition. Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranates behind your veil. It's not a continuation of the last song. It's just another approach into the mystery of it. Hence the pomegranates and the veil and all of that. So the man speaks to the woman of her beauty. Tirza was the capital city of the Northern Kingdom from the time of Jeroboam to that of Omri. And it was Omri who built a special capital called Samaria on the ridge of the spine of the mountains going north-south through Palestine. And Tirza is in there facing the, facing the Jordan River. So it's inward-looking. It was their world. The big thing about Samaria was it faced out to the Mediterranean, the Greek world and trade, and it was a kind of a new paradigm, if you like. So that was Tirza, and Jerusalem, as you know, is the capital of the southern kingdom. She inspires all, like the splendid fortified cities with their mighty armies carrying splendid, colourful standards. And verse 5-7 echo themes we've heard in earlier verses. And to conclude the seventh psalm, chapter 6, verse 8, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. So this is Solomon, if you like, plenty of options, but you're the one I want. My dove, my perfect one, is unique, the darling of her mother. That's cute. Flawless to her that bore her. The maidens see her and reckon her happy, the queens and concubines also, and they praise her. So far he's been addressing her, and now he boasts of her. There are echoes here of the poem that compared the marriage bed to Solomon's litter. No one in the royal harem can compare to the woman he loves. In her own family, she is her mother's favourite. And the chorus of the last words, who is this that looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners?
From the legion.
That's right. Her beauty is as the beauty of the heavens, the army with banners. The banners now are the myriad of the stars, the lights, God's heavenly host. Good, well, it's time for a break. I think we'll get rid of this.